Medical Matters on Talk About, brought to you in association with the Bon Secours Hospital Tralee, celebrating 100 years of advanced medicine and exceptional care.
Now, Dr. Eamon Shanahan joins us in Farron 4. Good afternoon, Eamon.
Deirdre, how are you doing?
I'm not too bad. Listen, I know we're going to take general queries this afternoon, but before we come to that...
Indeed.
There was an article in the Irish Independent today. Now, I know you're an Irish Times reader, Eamon, but I spotted this and I thought it was very interesting.
I look at the Independent as well, yeah.
You do look at the Independent as well.
Yeah.
I'm just going to read a little bit to you because I think... listeners will be very interested to hear your take on this. It's written by a columnist called Sinead Ryan, and she was in Turkey recently. She went to Istanbul for a weekend break, but when she was coming back from her holidays on Turkish Airlines, she said on the plane it looked frankly like a war zone. There was patients with their heads bandaged, others with plasters covering obvious stitches, occasional seeping wounds, women with strapped breasts visible under loose clothing, or swollen lips, avoiding the in-flight meal, gingerly sipping from straws. She says, had there been a queue, an uprising causing injury to hundreds? No, they were all returning home from surgery. What do you make of this? There's something like a number of people already this year have actually died in Turkey, and they went over there for surgery. It's extraordinary.
Yeah, so the situation is that there is, and this is not an Irish or indeed a European phenomenon, this is a worldwide phenomenon. It's the it's euphemistically referred to as medical tourism. And so the thing is that what happens is that in certain parts of the world, certain surgical procedures are carried out at much lower cost than they are in other parts of the world. Now, I need to be extremely careful about what I say next. The practicalities of this are that much of the surgery is very successful, and I've had patients myself who've been to other jurisdictions where they've had surgery carried out very effectively. The difficulty is like all of these things, is that the service that's provided essentially covers the operation and not an awful lot more. So people are very much at their own devices. And if they do run into complications, it's the health service of their own country that has to pick up the pieces when the individuals run into problems. So it's not going to stop people going for these procedures. It's just to be aware of the fact that you may have difficulties if you get back and you run into complications.
Yeah, a lot of the procedures seem to be cosmetic ones as well, when you hear her describing the people with the big lips and the obviously people going for what's commonly known as boob jobs.
Yeah. Again, I'm aware of the fact that there would be a significant part of this kind of travel. Let's put it this way. Again, I stress that this is absolutely not an Irish phenomenon. This is a phenomenon the world over. And indeed, there are procedures that are being undertaken that aren't, strictly speaking, directly involved in the person's health. Although straight away, I know that people will say that there are some of these procedures that do have an impact on the person's health. So I'm reluctant to pass any comment on that. I go back to the point I made earlier on. The difficulty is that if you're having surgery outside the jurisdiction, you need to make reasonably certain that the person involved is appropriately qualified. See, part of the thing is that, for example, if you have surgery in Ireland, it is now the case that no doctor may operate in Ireland unless that they have not just the appropriate registration and qualifications, but also that they're indemnified, that they, in the event of something unfortunately going wrong, that there is indemnity. You can't work in Ireland unless you've got medical indemnity. It's the law of the land. This may not necessarily be the case abroad. So the thing is that if somebody is going abroad for surgery, if everything works out, happy days, and people get procedures sooner and probably cheaper than they would get if they were trying to look for them here. But if they run into trouble, they're very much left to their own devices.
Yeah, it's worrying. I mean, personally, I can't imagine being in a foreign country and undergoing an operation. I mean, so far from home, so far from people who speak your language and who know you and who have to eyeball you in the street the week after the operation. I don't understand it, but it is a phenomenon. Eamon, we better move on anyway to some general medical queries. We'll start with this one. A listener says her legs, she's 72, she's getting a lot of pains in her legs and they feel very heavy. She's wondering what it might be.
Okay, there's a couple of things there. Kind of the heavy sensations tend to be where the legs are congested, where there's extra fluid in the legs. Now, straight away I'll say that this very heavy, humid weather, lots of people are finding various limbs, but especially the legs, getting very swollen and heavy as a consequence, just literally because of, it's just, they're getting more swollen legs because of the heat. I think the thing we need to watch out for is there anything else going on? And particularly if, apart from the heavy legs, if our listener has any other symptoms, if you have concerns about it, this is something I'd suggest that you talk to your GP about. It may be that it's just the weather. When things cool down, all of this will go away. But on the other hand, if you have anything else going on, it might be appropriate to get yourself checked out.
A caller says her partner, who's over 60, is carrying a bit of weight. His ankle is swelling up regularly. He has been getting injections, but it's continuing to swell up. What can he do?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things. Well, first and foremost, I think there's probably two separate issues there. The issue of the weight is probably separate from the swelling of the ankles. And I'm not sure, and you see, part problem is, again, it's lack of information. Why is our listener's partner getting injections, and for what? Joint injections, if that is indeed what it is, can be used. If you remember, we had Mr. Gardesi on with us a couple of weeks ago, and he was talking about the fact that when people are carrying extra weight, it does tend to accelerate problems like arthritis in the hips and knees, and getting the weight down can be helpful for the joints. And indeed, for some people who have painful joints, especially the knees, injecting the knees can be very beneficial, but in a number of cases won't work. And it sort of just making the presumption for a minute that the issue is one with arthritis, it may very well be that this, our listener's partner, might end up having to have knee surgery, but that's a presumption that I have to make in the absence of information.
A listener says she's in her 50s and she's a problem with her knee. She had an MRI and which found there was loose cartilage, wear and tear. Yeah. She's wondering, yeah, is there any exercises she could do to relieve the problem?
Straight away I say talk to a physio. And I mean, I think it's really important that you would talk to a physio. The reason being that, don't forget that, okay, you've done the imaging at this stage. Get a copy of the MRI report and bring it with you to your physio. Show it to the physio. What the physios will do is they'll carry out their own assessment of your joints. And what they'll look at is, and what they know is, all the, what they call origins and insertions, where muscles come from, where they go to, what's the nerve supply, what's the blood supply to the muscles, and then the tendons, the ligaments, and they will put together a specific personalized exercise regime for the individual that'll help build up muscles, that'll help reduce your symptoms. Long story short, talk to a physio.
Now, a listener in her 50s says she has a brown-coloured skin tag in her armpit for a number of years. She's asked her doctor to check it twice and he's told her it's just a skin tag and nothing to worry about. But she's still worried about it and is wondering if she should get it removed.
Has it changed? That's the thing. I mean, I suppose there's two aspects to this. First and foremost, is it just an annoyance? Is it something that gets in the way? Is it unsightly? Is it getting caught in the clothes or something like that? And that of itself might be justification for removing it. On the other hand, if it has undergone change, in other words, if it's getting bigger, if it bleeds, if it changes colour, that kind of stuff, it may be that there's something else going on, and that would be another reason to remove it. Lots of people have lots of skin tags, and the vast majority of the skin tags are completely, completely benign. Again, most of the time surgery is reasonably straightforward, and most of the time surgery shouldn't be without complications. But the balance you're looking at is, for all surgery, there's no such thing as trivial surgery. There's less complicated and more complicated surgery. Is that, on balance, does taking this tag off improve your health, or could it put you at risk of further problems if you have the surgery? These are the judgment calls that you have to make and your doctor will be making.
But I suppose with the minor surgery like that, you'd be talking about a local anaesthetic, wouldn't you?
Yes, exactly. Again, and in the vast, vast, vast majority of cases, that's exactly what it is. It is minor surgery and it is relatively straightforward and there shouldn't be any problems. But the difficulty is, even with minor surgery, people can get infections where the surgery happened. So it's just that balance I'm talking about. Now, look, if it's annoying you enough, I'm sure there's somebody who'll be able to remove it for you. And it might be that it's just the presence of it. To be fair, most of the time, if the thing is soft and squashy, simple as, if it's soft and squashy, the likelihood is there's nothing bad or dangerous about it. Again, assuming it's not changing. If it's changing, that's a whole different ball of wax. If on the other end it's not changing, it's the same size, same colour, same shape, and soft and squashy, it's certainly not dangerous. But if it's annoying you, get rid of it.
This next question, Eamon, I'm not even entirely sure if it is a medical question, but I'll put it to you anyway. It's from a 35-year-old man. He says, I can't seem to grow a beard. Can the doctor please give me advice?
Yeah, so that is something that is potentially medical. So the issue here is that he may be lacking in a variety of hormones. So the main male hormone is testosterone, and he may be lacking. This is one of those cases where there may be a true and genuine deficiency of testosterone, of the male hormone, but it's a bit more complicated than that, because it may be that he's missing other hormones as well too. Testosterone production is controlled, and much of the hormones in our body are controlled by a master gland at the base of the brain called the pituitary. And if the pituitary isn't working properly, this can lead to a variety of medical problems. So the thing is that it's not the issue of being able to grow the beard or not. It's, is there other things going on? So this is something you need to talk to your own GP about, and they'll organise the appropriate screening blood tests for you and then take it from there.
A listener wants to know, are gabapentin tablets good for nerve pain, and how safe are they for an elderly person?
Really, really interesting question. So GABA, gamma amino butyric acid, is a neurotransmitter. It's a chemical in our brain that transmits a variety of signals. There are two medications, at least, in fact many medications, but there's two in particular that affect the transmission of these chemicals in our brain. One of them is called pregabalin and the other one is called gabapentin. They are effective treatments for nerve pain. They weren't initially developed for nerve pain. As far as I know, they were actually originally developed as a treatment for epilepsy, but are now very widely used as a treatment for nerve pain. The question about safety is a very complex one. The reason is that because they're centrally acting medications, they may cause drowsiness. And it depends on the individual. Some people take one of these tablets and they're asleep for 24 hours. Other people take buckets of these tablets and it doesn't affect them at all. Particularly in the elderly, because of their sensitivity to medication, because the liver and the kidneys aren't working as well. The thing is that it may take less medication to make the person drowsy or sedated. And in the elderly, where their coordination is already poor, the big concern is if they fall and if they trip, or if they trip and fall and hurt themselves and break something, and that's a concern. There's also an issue, and there's also a concern that for some people these drugs may be drugs of addiction, that people can develop a dependence on these medications, and this is certainly a significant issue as well. So the thing is that it's a complex question. It's something they're going to have to talk to their own GP about. It's going to be very much a case of if you have to use it, and if there's no other alternatives, what's the smallest dose you can get away with for the shortest period of time.
Fair enough. Eamon, we are going to take a short break, but we have a question about cold sores coming up next, and I suppose there's a lot of those around as well, winter and summer. If anyone in the meantime wants to put another question to Eamon, you can phone it through to Brenda on 066 712 3666. If you prefer to text or WhatsApp the studio directly, you'll find us on 083 300 3300, and as always the email address is talkabout@radiokerry.ie. Back with more Medical Matters after these.
Talk About on Radio Kerry. Brought to you.
Medical Matters on Talk About. Brought to you in association with the Bonsecours Hospital Tralee. Celebrating 100 years of advanced medicine and exceptional care.
Now, back to your questions. Eamon, this listener says, can you ask the doctor what I can do for repeated cold sores, and not just on my lips? It's severe. I take L-lysine daily, I wear lip balm with SPF, I eat healthily, and I use Sudocream on them, but they're very embarrassing.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. I'd stop using the Sudo. There is a great attraction for the Irish, for people in Ireland who use Sudocream mostly because it's produced here. The problem with the Sudocream is very drying. It's great for surface lesions, but I keep it away from cold sores, quite apart from anything else. The problem is you may transmit the virus to other parts of your body. If it is really troublesome to you, probably the only thing that's actually going to make a difference is to ask a doctor to see if they would prescribe an antiviral medication for you. There's a well-known antiviral cream that you can get. Any chemist can get you sorted out for the active ingredient is acyclovir. But sometimes people need the antiviral medication if you're getting the cold sores. If you're getting the virus in other parts of your body, so I have to remember this one, it's the HSV, the herpes simplex type 1 virus, I think, is the one that causes cold sores. Anyway, the thing, it's HSV type 2 is the one that causes, no, it's herpes zoster, different virus. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Talk to your GP about perhaps getting an antiviral medication to try and control this thing. All the good lifestyle is good to stand to, but unfortunately won't make any difference to the cold sores.
We do hear as well, but I wonder, is it a myth that you're more prone to getting cold sores if you're run down? Is that right?
A very hard one to test. I know that anecdotally people will say that. The truth of it is that some people are misfortunate. I mean, we probably all get exposed to the virus at some stage in our lives. The problem is that for some individuals, under certain circumstances, the darn thing will flare up. But that's the problem. What are those some things that cause it to flare up? And I don't think anybody's done the studies to say whether it is being run down is the cause or not. I suppose it is the case that if somebody is grievously unwell, if they've got serious other illness, they are more prone to all sorts of viral infections. But that's because their immune systems are suppressed. But we're talking about people with end-stage cancers, people with HIV and things like that.
A texter wants to know, Eamon, if you can discuss, now I might pronounce this incorrectly, vulvodynia. In menopause.
Oh, yeah, so it does.
What is it?
Ooh, tricky. Okay, a painful vulva. That's literally what it is. It's a pain of the vulva. And so the thing is, there are a number of women who will suffer from this. And it's not just at menopause, but they can suffer throughout life. This is something that you probably need to see a gynecologist about. You can certainly talk to your GP. But basically what it is, it's a nerve pain of the vulva. That's probably the best way to describe it. It can be desperately unpleasant and sore. So you can imagine trying to sit down can be uncomfortable, passing urine can be uncomfortable, intercourse can be really, really uncomfortable, and all these things being probably exacerbated by the change when things get a bit drier in the vulva because of menopause. You remember we were talking earlier on about the gabapentoids, pregabalin and gabapentin. Those two medications, along with amitriptyline, are medications that can be used for this. I'm not aware of any surgical procedures that are going to make a huge, great difference to this. I know that those women who are unfortunate enough to have this condition will, from time to time, have to be seen by consultant gynecologists to try and get this thing sorted out.
Here's an interesting one, Eamon. Listener, no, I'm not sure whether she says she's over 70 or there were over 70 people on the bus, but she was on a coach tour recently. She wore a mask for the duration. The bus was full, yeah. And she was the only person on the bus wearing a mask. And she said, am I right?
Yeah, okay, it's all about reducing the transmission of infection. Okay, this time of the year, generally we're seeing not much in the way of viral infections. And that's typical and that's normal. That's been the case since time immemorial. So right now, this minute, the risk of viral infection is low, but not gone. I think the thing is, for people who are otherwise immune, and I suspect it's because our listener is over 70 rather than being 70 people in the bus, she is protecting her own health. It doesn't matter what anybody else does. The reality is she's protecting her own health. It's worth bearing in mind that because people in places like China and Korea and places like that would have suffered from things like MERS and SARS and stuff like that, they have a tradition of wearing masks, and they will wear masks at the drop of a hat, something Europeans and Americans haven't got into doing yet.
Now, a male in his 50s is wondering if there's an over-the-counter cream for skin keratosis lumps on his arms.
So keratosis just means you've got lumps of hard skin. I suppose part of the thing that would be at the back of my head is, why do you have the lumps of hard skin in the first place? The kind of things that can be used for treatment of warts could potentially be used for the treatment of keratosis. But keratosis are an indication that the skin is being irritated chronically. Now, when we use the word chronically, we mean it's from the word Greek word chronos, meaning time. It's something that, so there's a chronic or a long-term irritation of the skin, and the skin is responding to that by producing extra skin. So taking away the lumpy skin is taking away the result, but is not treating the cause of this thing. So you need to go back to, why are you getting these lumps in the first place, and deal with that rather than deal with the lumps themselves.
A listener says, will you ask Eamon if a GP can do anything for a hammer toe? I've been to a podiatrist, but nothing has helped.
Not really, no. It's an uncomfortable and sore condition. We tend to refer people on to the orthopaedic surgeons, and they're the ones who actually get that sorted out.
Okay. Just this is a good one, actually, to clarify, just bearing in mind the first discussion we had this week on medical matters, Eamon, about people going abroad for surgery. Yeah. A listener says, but yeah, what's Eamon's yeah opinion on going to Belfast for eye and hip surgery? Well, that's a completely different story.
Absolutely. So the thing about it is that you're within, okay, I was going to say within the jurisdiction and obviously a politically loaded answer, but the reality is that you're looking at, in that case, you're actually looking at a company that has presence on both sides of the border. They actually have services in the Republic as well as in the North. And the thing is that you're looking at the kind of surgery you're talking about is on the, in the terms of complexity, is very much at the lower end of complexity compared to some of the procedures that are carried out in the likes of Turkey and Spain.
A caller says he or she is immunocompromised and they went sea swimming and swallowed some seawater and now they're worried that this could be harmful.
No. Dilution. Think about it. If anything gets into the seawater, it's going to be vastly diluted. Now, to be fair, why do we have blue flags, Deirdre? Why have we got blue flags at all? It's all about quality of our seawater. And correct me if I'm wrong, most, I know it's not every single one, but most of Kerry's beaches have blue flags, isn't that right?
Yeah, they do indeed.
And that's the reason, and the reason for that is because the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, are testing the water to make sure that it's clean and safe. So I think the risk is very low.
Okay, and one final one. A lady in her 70s says she has very purple lips. Is this a sign of heart problems?
It could be, and I think that's a fair comment. It's not something we see very often these days, so the term we use is cyanosis, and that's purple lips, and it indicates that the person is lacking in oxygen. One of the things that might be worthwhile doing is, during COVID and even to this day, a good thing out of COVID, if there's any such thing, is that there are a lot of these so-called pulse oximeters around, you know, those things that measure oxygen levels. And if you put on a pulse ox, and if your oxygen level is around 97 or 98% or 96%, then the purple lips are just the way you are. But if, on the other hand, your oxygen saturation is around, say, 80%, then yes, you're lacking in oxygen and there's something else going on.
Okay, fair enough. Well, listen, Eamon, we're going to leave it there. But thank you very much for that, as always.
No problem at all.
Great advice there. Great medical advice for Eamon. And we look forward to catching up with him again next week. Thanks a million, Eamon. Now, it